Good morning. We'll call our second case for this morning, 06-AP-0102-CR, State versus Sumner. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Stephen Kleinmeier. Mr. Kleinmeier.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the state, the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this case. It's the state's position that in this case, the Court of Appeals' primary error was in applying a divide and conquer analysis when deciding whether the circumstances known to the officers, when they decided those circumstances, failed to provide reasonable suspicion to justify the frisk. We think contrary to the Court of Appeals' decision, the officers' concern for their safety that was rose out of initially seeing the defendant make reaching gestures towards the passenger side of a car were not mitigated by the passage of time, the 15 minutes between that, the approximate 15 minutes between that and when the frisk was conducted.
Do you think 15 minutes are part of the total circumstances and can be considered?
In the context of this case, I really don't think they're significant because I don't think nothing really happened during that 15 minutes.
Okay, but it's part of the circumstances.
It's part of the circumstances.
You can either think they're important or you think it's unimportant, but it's part of the circumstances.
Yes.
You think that the Court of Appeals gave it undue weight?
Yes, because in the sense that they said that this passage of time with nothing happening somehow mitigated the concern that arose out of the initial gestures. And I don't think that there was really nothing that happened during that time to make things feel worse or to mitigate it. I mean, Mr. Sumner was sitting in his car, the police officers were sitting in their squad car, one of them watching him.
And so determining that the defendant in this case had a suspended license has no bearing one way or the other in the analysis. Because that happened in the 15 minutes, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, no, in terms of contributing to a factor that would justify the frisk itself, directly, no. I mean, I think the three primary factors that the trial court relied upon and that the Court of Appeals identified as factors that could contribute to reasonable suspicion were Mr. Sumner's reaching gestures towards the passenger side of the car, he exhibited nervousness and was reaching in his pockets. The officer said the officer told him two or three times not to do it, and Mr. Sumner continued to do it, and the officer conducted the frisk.
The Court of Appeals, as I recall, relied on the Moore case, and if they didn't, I think they did, though. And in Moore, and I'm reading from paragraph 16, it says, although Moore appeared nervous, was resistive, and refused to remove his hands from his pockets, these circumstances did not give the officer a reasonable suspicion that Moore was dangerous. Now I get to the important part. Especially when the officer had spent the previous 20 minutes at the scene without any suspicious incidents. So the Moore Court and the Court of Appeals here just took a different view of the 15 or 20 minutes, depending on what case you're talking about. And from their rationale, and it cites Moore, that is, the Court of Appeals here cites Moore in paragraph 21, we conclude that a reasonable officer would not have thought Moore was armed and dangerous after 20 minutes had elapsed on the scene without incident. It's that same kind of rationale, but you see it through a little different perspective as how you approach that 15 or 20 minutes.
Yes, there are two aspects of this 15 or 20 minutes where I think Moore and the Court of Appeals are wrong. One, the mere passage of time, if nothing happens, and in this point, nothing did happen during that 15 minutes. And also, appears to be the assumption that an officer shows concern for his safety or that it's always safest for everyone if the officer orders the person out of the car. Just prior to the quote you used from Moore, that said apparently the officer was not concerned for his safety when he initially made the traffic stop because he did not order the passengers out of the vehicle. Well, we have in our brief pointed out that there's different advice given to officers under different circumstances. Sometimes it's safer for the officer to get the people out of the car. Sometimes it's not safer. Sometimes it's better to keep them in the car. So I think the court was wrong to say that a reasonable officer would have gotten Mr. Sumner out of the car. It's up to the officer's discretion whether to order the person out of the car to leave him in. I don't think you can automatically draw a conclusion that the officer wasn't concerned for safety or that the safest by leaving him in the car or that the safest procedure was to get him out of the car. That's for the officer
Brian
to
Meyer,
determine.
Let me ask you a question. My understanding is that a couple of times the officers asked whether or not the defendant would agree to searching the car, and he refused twice. Is that a factor that we can look at when looking at the totality of the circumstances?
I don't think his refusal can be used. I mean, that's his right to refuse the search. So I don't think the fact he reviews can contribute to that.
Well, he may have a right to walk away from a police officer and not answer questions. But if he runs, that's viewed as suspicious. So why isn't it suspicious? Hey, if I have nothing to hide, I mean, you see this all the time. You hear it all the time. If I have nothing to hide, I'd let him search my vehicle. I may have a right not to, but, you know, it's going to make them very suspicious of me if I'm not letting them search. Because if I have nothing to hide, I'd open the door and let them search, right? I mean, that's how most people think, right?
Well, it may be the way people think, but I mean, I don't think that the court's going to say that a person exercising his right to deny consent can be used to justify a frisk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's different
than fleeing.
Just because the fact that you run from the officer, I mean, in those cases where that comes up, that the court says that the fleeing itself is an indicating something about the mind.
Well, but you have a right to move away. You have a right not to answer the questions. But if you walk fast, you're in trouble.
Well, walking again, as I recall.
Why I added the word fast.
Yeah.
That's why. Trot, run, walk fast, running, all of them are a little different. But standing at the car and saying, heck no, I don't think that raises suspicion.
I don't think the courts would allow a person exercising his rights
well,
to raise
I didn't ask you whether the court would allow it. I'm just asking, and I think that's what Justice Crooks was asking you.
Okay, I don't think that...
Cops would be suspicious.
Well, you know...
It may not be Terry versus Ohio, but it's suspicious.
Yeah, in you know, their own mind, yeah.
Apart from
the legal requirements, right. It might. But
it has to be what? Reasonable and articulable suspicion. What I hear you saying is, you could understand it, but you better not articulate it because it can't be used as a legal reason. Is that pretty much
what it gets to? Yes, it would not be an acceptable reason.
Could I? The car was impounded. Is that right?
Yes.
And a citation was given before the car was impounded.
In the sense that the tow truck didn't show up until. I mean, he was given a citation before the tow truck showed up. Yes.
What? How was Mr. Summers supposed to get home or wherever he was going?
There's some discussion that he was thinking he was going to be walking home.
When did that discussion, when did that fact come up in relation to these other facts?
It's not entirely clear, frankly. Let's see. Pretty quickly.
Was he close to home? Was there any thought of giving him a ride? Was there ever any thought of taking him to jail before they found substances?
There was no mention of jail. I mean, this was suspension of I don't think it was a jailable offense where they take him. My recollection, it was this was on think, at 18th Street in Milwaukee, and there was nothing specific that I recall in the record identifying precisely how far that would have been from Mr. Sumner's residence. I think his residence was identified, and I had a general impression, but I'm not sure how accurate that would be, so I'm not going to try and guess what that would be. I'm quickly trying to find. The officer did.
What I'm trying to get at is can we completely rule out any concern that the officers were going to transport Mr. Sumner's in their squad cars any place?
Yeah, there's no indication that they planned to do that prior to the point when a frisk was conducted.
Do you know if there's anywhere in the record where it's clear as to who reached in the pocket?
The police officer testified that he was doing the police officer testified Mr. Sumner reached into the pocket. Mr. Sumner testified the police officer reached into the pocket. The trial court found that the officer told Mr. Sumner to reach into the pocket. And I don't think there's any evidence to support that precise finding. I think the finding would have had to have been either according to the police officer, Mr. Sumner reached in, or according to Mr. Sumner, the police officer reached in. The trial court found, as an overall matter, the police officer was credible. So if you take that finding, the police officer was credible, then under the police officer's testimony, he was doing the frisk, felt something in the pocket that the officer said he knew was not a weapon, but he asked Mr. Sumner what it was, and Mr. Sumner said it's a napkin, and Mr. Sumner then reached in, pulled it out, put that on top of the car. And after that point, the officers resumed the frisk, said he looked down and saw something fall out of the pants, saw two packets, asked Mr. Sumner what that was, and he said it was heroin. The officer then arrested him, and after the arrest, then opened up those napkins that had been placed on the car.
So there were several bindles.
Yeah, I think there were like two bindles seen on the ground and three, I think, in the napkin that had been placed on top of the car.
So the bindles are seen on the ground before the napkin on the car was
opened. Yes.
Well, he lives, according to this, at 2974 North Fratney Avenue. I don't know where that is.
Yeah, I associate that with being on the east side of Milwaukee, but I've been a long time since then, so I don't know how accurate that would be.
Okay. As you were saying before you were interrupted, Mr. Kornmeyer.
Well, actually, the questions went right to some of the parts of the Court of Appeals opinion that we think had the biggest disagreement with. Those were paragraphs 21 and 22, and then also the final paragraph, paragraph 28. I think those kind of summarize pretty much where the problem comes. Because in paragraph 28, the court says, as in Moore, the lapse of time between the stop and the frisk mitigated any reasonable suspicion. Any objectively reasonable officer would not leave an occupant of the vehicle who is believed to be armed and dangerous unattended for 15 minutes. And while the reaching gesture at the initiation of the stop may have aroused suspicion, the fact the stop proceeded for the next 15 minutes without incident while Sumner was unattended mitigated suspicion. Now, first of all, I don't think he was unattended. I mean, the officer was not standing next to him, but during that 15 minutes, after initially approaching the car, the officer returned to his squad car, and he said it was an SUV, so it sat up a little bit higher. So, in other words, he could be looking down into Mr. Sumner's car, and he kept an eye on him for that 15 minutes. And the officer said Mr. Sumner did nothing suspicious during that time. So basically nothing happened during that 15 minutes. But I don't think it's really accurate to say he was unattended in the sense that he was ignored. And as far as the passage of 15 minutes, I think in this case that's completely neutral because nothing happened during that 15 minutes. Nothing.
Well, look, I'm not saying I don't know how it should be viewed. We focused a moment ago on this 15 or 20 minutes and we also focused prior to that on the issue of around the fact of the officer asked a couple of times, can I search? The answer is no.
And we're talking about, you know, is that suspicion? Is it reasonable suspicion? Is it articulable suspicion? I don't know if I can take the Court of Appeals so much to task for saying, hey, if the officer was so concerned that he was concerned that he was armed and dangerous, they may not have, in the totality of circumstances, let it go on that long. I mean, you put a different slant on it. I understand it. In fact, in some ways, I see your question as, must a police officer conduct an unlawful frisk or engage in possibly unsafe procedure to demonstrate a serious concern for safety so that the defendant's conduct that caused this, I mean, that's the way I see you framing the Court of Appeals opinion. And I don't think that they're saying, oh, the officer has to engage in an unlawful frisk or do something that's inherently unsafe.
Well, Your Honor, I think this came up in part in response to the Moore case, because as we pointed out in Moore, the court said, well, the officer must not have been concerned for safety. He didn't get him out of the car. And in the Court of Appeals, I tried to distinguish Moore by saying, well, there was evidence that this officer was concerned about safety. First of all, he asked if he could search, and he told Mr. Sumner that he was asking in part because he had seen the reaching gestures. He said it was for concern. And the trial court in this case made a finding that the officer was concerned for his safety. Twice the officer referred to the officer having fear. So in response to those arguments, the Court of Appeals said, no, there's no evidence. We're not going to find he was concerned for his safety, because an officer, if he was concerned for safety, would have conducted a frisk. Except they've already said, and the state doesn't disagree with that, that up until that point, there was no reasonable suspicion to justify a frisk. Consistent with the Court of Appeals decision in the Johnson case and this court's decision in the Johnson case earlier this year, just a reaching gesture probably would not have been enough. But that didn't mean it wouldn't still raise an officer's concern about his safety. He wouldn't justify the frisk, but he could still be concerned about his safety. And in response to those arguments, the Court of Appeals said, well, if he was concerned for safety, he would have conducted a frisk. But he couldn't, because he didn't have reasonable suspicion. And they said if he was concerned for his safety, he would have gotten the man out of the car. But the officer said he was concerned about his safety, and the trial court made a finding that the officer was credible and that the officer was concerned for his safety. So in light of those findings and the facts of this case, which are different from Moore, I don't know why the Court of Appeals can say that just the fact he didn't do a frisk and didn't get him out of the car shows he wasn't concerned for his safety.
Aren't officers always, or shouldn't they be, always concerned about their safety in a traffic stop? I mean, the whole point is you don't know who you're stopping. You don't know whether they're armed or not. You don't know whether they're a fleeing felon or have warrants out that they don't want to have. You have no idea about it. Aren't officers supposed to view all circumstances as potentially dangerous?
Yes, I hope they do. But in this case, in addition to that general concern, they had seen Mr. Sumner make what they said reaching gestures towards the passenger side of the car. And then when the officer approached the car, he looked in and he saw there was all kinds of stuff in the car that could have been hiding something. He said could have been hiding a weapon. So those
the reason. Remove him from the car.
No.
He left him in a car which he thought might have a weapon.
Yes, but if there's some of those advice that's given officers is it's also safer to leave the person in the car because they have their motion is more restricted when they're in the car than when they're out walking around. And if he's not going to be able to frisk the person, when that person could have been putting something in the, you know, when he's making the reaching gesture, could have been hiding something in that stuff in the car, or he could have been retrieving something to use if he'd gotten out of the car. So I think the fact the officer left in the car, that's the officer's call to what he thinks is safe. But anyway, I think that reaching gesture and seeing the stuff in the car provided more than just the general, provide the officer reason to be concerned for safety in addition to just the general concern they should always have in a traffic stop.
Because all cases involving the Terry search are so fact-specific, why do you think the court took this case? I mean, the rules and law on a Terry search are really very well stated. And isn't this just an application? And maybe reasonable people can disagree about the application, but why should this court take this case? And what do you, the state, want to come out of this case that will clarify the law and help the officers and citizens understand this?
Well, I think the court, the reason we emphasized, I thought we emphasized in the petition for review, was the way the Court of Appeals split up the factors in this case by saying that the time mitigated the initial gesture so that it really didn't take it into account when it considered the nervousness and the reaching in the pockets. And also the fact that in Moore and in this case, the court seems to assume that the safest procedure for an officer is always getting the person out of the car. Because they say in Moore, especially, that by leaving the people in the car, the officer indicated he wasn't concerned for his safety. And I think those factors, the idea of 15 minutes during which nothing really happened, I don't think, to mitigate what had been seen or to enhance it. I mean, those two factors, leaving the person in the car and those 15 minutes, should not be considered by the court. The court should have considered all those factors together. The reaching gesture.
You said two different things, or I heard you. Maybe you didn't intend to say two. One, can they be considered, whether the person's in or out of the car, and whether there was a 15-minute break? Started the sentence saying they should not be considered. But when we pressed you earlier, you said it's all part of the totality.
Well, they're all circumstances, but in terms of what's important in whether an officer had reasonable suspicion, I think that the fact he left him in the car is not important because it's the officer's call to determine what he or she thinks is the safest procedure.
Right.
And in terms of the 15 minutes, there may be times when something happens during that 15 minutes that could be significant. But in this case, it didn't. But according to the Moore case, that court makes it sound like any time you leave someone in the car for 20 minutes, 15 minutes, then it's going to be hard to show reasonable suspicion afterwards because the fact you left him in the car, according to Moore, indicates you weren't concerned for your safety.
You want us not only to overturn this case, but you want us to put a couple of slugs into the Moore case.
Well, frankly, yes, because of the...
You can see how
the Court of Appeals in this case felt bound by Moore, or good, followed
yeah, well,
Moore anyway.
Sure, it's precedent.
Yeah. And I think that's I think in this case you should take out that 15 minutes and leaving them in and then put all those three factors together. And when you're looking at the reaching gesture and the nervousness and then the reaching in the pockets, even when told not to, I think that provides the reasonable suspicion.
Doesn't this begin, at least this portion of the argument, begin, middle, and end with under the totality of the circumstances? Sometimes... it sounds to me like you're suggesting that they could never, appellate court could never consider in the totality of the circumstances whether the defendant was left in or out. It sounds to me like you're arguing, and I say, huh, makes a big difference. Now here, you know, what if you had five officers at the scene versus one officer at the scene? I'll tell you, without Moore, I'd say, and I don't mean M-O-H-R, I mean without M-O-R-E, without Moore, I'd say, woo, if I were a single officer at the scene, I'd be less inclined to get anyone out if I were fearing for my safety until other people came. So doesn't it all depend on the circumstances, whether someone should be in or out, whether or not, in some cases, leaving someone in for a period of 5 minutes, 15 minutes, it all depends on the totality of the circumstances.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but it's the Moore case that takes out the totality and circumstances. When you leave someone in the car for 20 minutes, that demonstrates that you're not concerned
for
safety.
Under those circumstances, it's not a per se rule.
Well, but that's not the way the Court of Appeals in this case applied Moore. They just, even though in this case, in Moore, nothing, the defendant there did nothing until he was out and they did the reaching in the pockets. In this case, there was the reaching gesture to begin with, plus what the officer saw in the car. But the Court of Appeals in this case still applied Moore as though nothing happened initially. So you have the Court of Appeals in this case applying Moore as part of an all-time, an all-purpose rule holding, as opposed to looking at the totality of circumstances in this case.
How would you write this opinion?
I would write it by saying that the court erred in this case, saying the Court of Appeals erred. Court of Appeals erred in this case by finding that the 15 minutes during which nothing happened that would add to or subtract from that initial concern, that that 15 minutes somehow mitigated that initial concern so that it wasn't factored in with the others, and that the leaving the person in the car somehow mitigated that initial concern so it wasn't factored in with the nervousness and the reaching in the pocket.
Can I restate you? The Court of Appeals erred because 15 minutes was irrelevant.
In this case, it was irrelevant because nothing happened in this case during that 15 minutes.
In this case, because nothing happened. All right. In the Court of Appeals erred by relying on leaving the person in the car, because your view is this is per se a decision for the cops.
Well, we've cited the cases that is the officer's decision, and there was one question asked of the officer about why he left him in or along those lines, and he said, well, he felt he didn't have to get him out. I can find that page in a second so I can...
Okay, well, we can find that. You can find it while you're listening.
Okay.
May I ask one factual?
Justice Prosser.
This is sort of a hypothetical question, but Summers was given a citation for driving with a suspended license?
Initially, yes.
Okay. That really didn't reflect how he was driving and which caused the stop in the first place. Is that right?
Right.
What would... If he had not had a suspended license, what is the likely citation?
They didn't get too much into that in the case because, the officers explained that, I think it was about going, initially stopped him for going out of his lane and making cars in the oncoming lane dodge him because of moving out of the lane. For the exact statutory violation traffic violation, I don't know what that was.
They didn't have to give him a ticket, did they?
They didn't have to, and they didn't for the initial...
Right. They didn't have to. They could have gotten him out of the car. They could have frisked him anyway after the traffic violation.
Well, at the point of the traffic violation itself, there was not reasonable suspicion to a frisk.
No, but he made furtive gestures. Well, his hands were in and out of his pockets. He was nervous.
His nervousness and hands in and out of pockets occurred later, after they told him the car was going to be towed and after they started searching the car and after they gave him the citation. So when the car was initially stopped, they didn't have the nervousness and the reaching of the pockets. Mm-hmm. That came later.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if I can follow up the Chief's question. She asked you about furtive gestures. Now, my understanding of a furtive gesture is something clandestine, something secretive. And my understanding of the Johnson case was that reaching without more is not necessarily a furtive gesture. Would you agree with that characterization of Johnson or disagree?
Well, I know that the way the reaching was described in Johnson was not sufficient to...
The head bob.
Pardon?
It was a head bob.
And shoulders, yeah, and reaching down, and that was not sufficient. And we have not argued in this case that Mr. Sumner's initial reaching by itself would have justified a frisk. The officer apparently didn't think it justified a frisk because he didn't do one. But we think it's sufficient that it can be taken into account with the nervousness and the reaching in the pockets later to put them all together to show.
And I understand your position. I guess the point of my question is the automatic assumption that I think parties and courts often make, that a reach is necessarily a furtive gesture when it may not be. And which I think the import of Johnson was that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not you have something that crosses the line and that rises to reasonable suspicion that is, in fact, furtive.
Okay, so in other words, you're kind of to be classified as furtive. If something could be reach the level of being furtive, then it would be reasonable suspicion. I'm not sure I'm saying anything different. I guess all I'm saying is, in this case, and at any rate, the reaching gesture by itself. I mean, the officer didn't know what he's reaching for,
right?
And that's where the concern came from. But no one has argued in this case that by itself provided the reasonable suspicion. But we think it can go in with the others.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Mr. Albie Craig Albie, representing Nathaniel Sumner.
My name is Craig Albie. I represent Nathaniel Sumner. The Court of Appeals correctly considered the totality of the circumstances in finding that there was not reasonable suspicion to pat Mr. Sumner down for weapons in this case. We could begin by discussing the facts as they happen and discuss the applicable law as I go through the facts. As the Court is aware, Mr. Sumner was pulled over for a traffic violation. He pulled over immediately after the officers engaged their emergency lights. This was not a situation where there was any concern about flight. The officers, the deputy who testified, Deputy Johnson, indicated that he observed what he characterized as a reaching gesture as Mr. Sumner pulled over in response to the emergency lights. I think it's important and significant that the reaching gesture in this case is not described in any fashion whatsoever. In the Johnson case, the gesture was described with considerably greater detail, and yet that reaching gesture was not found to be sufficient for reasonable suspicion. There, as Justice Butler just noted, the officer observed the suspect bend down so that his head and shoulders disappeared from view. In the officer's experience, this looked like someone who was concealing a weapon or drugs. And it also looked like he was reaching under the seat, which might limit the number of explanations there would be for the driver's conduct in that particular case. Here, it's just simply described as a reaching gesture to the side of the car.
Mr. Albee, let me ask you about that, because as I recall Johnson, what was observed was head and shoulders movement, and the officers did not and could not see his hands. So you don't know whether, at least under the facts of that case, there was reaching or not. Whereas under the facts of this case, you actually have reaching, at least a description that there was a reaching. Don't you see that as somewhat a difference between the two cases?
Well, I think in Johnson, when the head and shoulders disappear from view, it's a reasonable inference that the driver is doing something down between his legs and that that's likely to be reaching, and that it would be consistent with putting something under the seat or getting something from under the seat. And, of course, there are all sorts of innocent explanations as to why a driver might do something under the seat. But here, this officer doesn't even say that he equated the gesture he saw with anything particularly suspicious. He didn't say, that's consistent in my experience with hiding drugs or contraband. He also, it appears that the gesture was just momentary. He doesn't describe it as being lengthy. He doesn't describe it as though Mr. Sumner were futzing around with something on the seat in the nature of trying to either get something out of a container or a bag or something, or to hide something in a container or a bag. And he also doesn't describe any actions by Mr. Sumner that would suggest he's maybe grabbing something and putting something in his pocket, because this is a Tahoe sitting up, and you'd expect that if he grabbed something to conceal in his pocket, that maybe he'd raise himself up on his haunches or something like that in order to conceal an object. We don't have any kind of description there that would lend credence to there being something improper here. We also have, in addition to the usual kinds of innocent explanations, some of which were explored in the Johnson case, of changing a radio station or fast food wrappers. We have cargo in this case, as the officer described. And as we all know, when we drive and we come to a stop and we have a lot of things in our front seat, they'll often be imbalanced and may require some contact to prevent them from moving. This is also a stick shift car, and the reaching gesture may have just been Mr. Sumner downshifting in order to pull over in response to the emergency vehicle. We just have no particulars here about this reaching gesture that would make it suspicious. It's far less detailed and suspicious than was the case in the Johnson case.
Counselor, are you saying that we can't consider the reaching as part of the totality of the circumstances?
No, not at all, Justice Rogenczak. It's certainly a factor, but We can't just say all reachings are the same, and it's on a continuum. And some reachings would be highly suspicious. I think then you get down to Johnson, which didn't provide reasonable suspicion, and I think this one falls somewhere beneath that. And if accompanied by other things, some of the cases that were cited by the state, for example, when an officer came to the car, there was, say, a coat covering the driver's lap or something like that, which added additional suspicion in the sense of, well, that could be a hiding place. This officer came to the window, and while he said there were many things in the car, he didn't identify anything in particular that he thought was threatening about the items in the car. He didn't say that Mr. Sumner engaged in any protective kind of conduct to conceal some area of the car from visibility. And I think, Chief Justice Abramson, you asked a question about is refusal to search something like flight. And I think that a refusal to search accompanied by some affirmative conduct to prevent an officer from viewing something that would be otherwise in his view may start coming a little bit closer to the flight analogy, in that there's something affirmative being done to interfere with the officers doing their duty. But of course we have nothing like that here. There was no flight. Mr. Sumner was cooperative, and in my view, the officer readily admitted both through his testimony, I think, and by his conduct, that he did not have a basis to search the car. But he was well aware that he is authorized to ask Mr. Sumner for consent. I think that's in the nature of a fishing expedition, completely lawful. The officer is entitled to ask that question for consent. But I think it just shows that at that time it was more of a fishing expedition than any real concern about there being a weapon in the car.
Was the car going to be searched sooner or later?
It appears that it was in fact searched. So I guess just based on the officer's testimony that the other deputy went to the car to search it, that was going to take place.
Let's suppose there had been no frisk, and Mr. Sumner had started to walk away. In the normal course of business, would the car have been searched?
Well, I don't think that the state established that this was pursuant to some department policy to make it a valid inventory search. It appears that the officers were intent on searching the car, and that was going to happen, as it did.
Are you saying there's nothing in the record, testimony-wise, to say that when a tow truck is called, they do an inventory search?
The officer testified that I know the judge indicated that he was aware that oftentimes there would be an inventory search of a car that was impounded. I have to tell the court I don't recall testimony from the officer to that effect. He certainly did not provide any details regarding what was the procedure, what were the policies, and whether they were triggered in this particular case.
Thank you.
There was a squad car. Was that a marked squad car?
I think it was a marked SUV, is my understanding.
Marked SUV. How would you describe the traffic incident?
Well, as the manner in which the circuit court found the traffic incident, the deputies were waiting for some traffic in front of them to make a turn. Mr. Sumner passed their vehicle, which, because this was just one lane in each direction, required him to go into the next lane of traffic. He did not do that at a high rate of speed. He passed the officer, waved at the officer as he went by. The officer said that oncoming traffic had to slow down to allow Mr. Sumner to complete that pass, but that there was no near collision or any kind of accident like that. And then the officers engaged their emergency lights, and Mr. Sumner immediately pulled over. And as I think you noted, Justice Prosser, there was no citation for that conduct. The following the officer's contact with Mr. Sumner at the car, he went back for 15 minutes, and they did a license check, found that Mr. Sumner was suspended. They wrote out the citation at that time so that they were able to present that to Mr. Sumner after they got him out of the car after the 15 minutes. I'd also note there's no evidence in this case that this was a high crime area. The time of day, I think, was about 9 o'clock. It was in the summer, so I'm not sure if I was trying to find it today. I thought there was testimony that it was dusk, although I admit I couldn't find that and may have just assumed that 9 o'clock in July meant that it was dusk. And for those 15 minutes, Mr. Sumner did not engage in any activity that the officer considered suspicious. And I definitely part ways with the state as to what one can make of that 15 minutes.
Mr. Albee, let me ask you about that. We bring our experiences here. My experience is to a degree involved two family members who are police officers. And my understanding of situations such as this, at least from the little I know, and from having heard cases also in circuit court, is that when you pull a vehicle over, until the point when you're ready to engage the individual, the driver of the vehicle, most officers will keep the individuals inside of the vehicle so that they can keep an eye on them, so that you don't have individuals who can take off, who can run, or who might present otherwise a threat. And so they like to have them inside the vehicle where they're confined and where they know where they are and they can see them readily, easily. And then at the point when you want to engage someone for conversation, you make the decision as to whether it's safer to have them in or outside of the vehicle. That's been my experience. So I'm not sure that you can read more into having someone inside the vehicle while those checks are taking place, either one way or the other, given the fact that that's at least how I understand officers are trained.
First of all, I don't believe that the Court of Appeals placed a lot of weight on that particular fact about leaving him in the car. I think it just simply demonstrated the fact that there was not sufficient suspicion here to pat him down at that time. In addition, I think it, and I would, let me back up, because I would agree with the court that the standard traffic stop that probably is the course, although I'm no expert and can't testify to that either. As has been pointed out, there is a generalized safety concern anytime there's a traffic stop. Police officers need to be cautious, and I think that probably is a standard routine way of handling things. You also don't want the driver to be in traffic, and it's probably easier to keep him in one place and prevent flight if that's what he had on his mind. However, I think that all changes if you believe that there's some realistic possibility that the person is armed. The usual traffic stop, I don't think that, while there's always the generalized concern that I have to be on the alert in case this person has a weapon, I don't think where you have some specific fact that really causes this worry in your mind that you'd leave him there with a gun where fast action at the time and saying, you get out of the car and monitor him more closely could be done, because the police officer could have had him get out of the car under MIM during that traffic stop, and I think that he didn't, because he didn't really have a very high level of suspicion at all that reaching gesture meant there was a weapon in the car. Because otherwise you'd want to, I think the natural, reasonable, common sense thing to do would be remove him from the car if you thought there was any real level of suspicion, even if it didn't rise to a reasonable level of suspicion.
I don't think the state would or has disagreed with you on that point. I think Mr. Kleinmeier's argument was that, at least at that point in time, there, I think he would concur that there was no reasonable suspicion. As I heard his argument, it was there were additional factors that weighed in here that led to reasonable suspicion.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is that not only is there not reasonable suspicion to allow a pat-down, but here, in the officer's mind, I think it's reasonable to conclude that he didn't even think it was at the level that I should get him out of the car. I mean, he could have thought, I don't have enough to pat him down. But, geez, that reaching gesture really made me a little uneasy, even if I can't put my finger on it. I should get him out of the car in case there is a gun in the car. I mean, it didn't even rise to the level of that kind of, you know, even a hunch, I guess.
Counselor, but what if he was putting a gun in his coat or his pocket rather than putting a gun in the car? You get him out of the car, you just got a bigger problem than you had before, right? I mean, there's no description about what the reaching did or didn't do, so it's not necessarily a conclusion that he was hiding something in the car. It could just as easily have been taking something from the car and putting it on his person, right?
Well, a couple things. Again, the reaching gesture wasn't described in such a way that would make it seem like he's putting something in his pockets. And I would remind the court that Mr. Sumner was wearing a T-shirt and running pants. So it would be more difficult to grab a gun, for instance, and then conceal it on his person in a way that the officers wouldn't see that from behind, because he doesn't have a big baggy coat, as was the case in Kyle's, to put the gun. And also, I think Mr. Sumner, if he were asked to get out of the car, as he later was, and he's wearing running pants and a T-shirt, I mean, that's one way to, I think, dispel the suspicion is by looking at him and seeing how unlikely it is that he'd be concealing a gun wearing those clothes. Not impossible, but certainly far less likely than was in the case in Kyle's, for example.
Mr. Albee, as I've listened to both of you, I've written down a number of things that I heard. A reaching gesture, the officer observed many items in the car, nervousness on the part of the defendant, hands in and out of his pockets despite being told not to do that. And then you said, well, maybe under all the circumstances you might consider the refusals to allow search. Now, when I put all of those together, applying the totality of the circumstances, why is there not reasonable suspicion under Terry to go ahead and have a pat-down?
First, let me start with a clarification. I don't think there's a finding in this case that he was told not to put his hands in his pocket. Ultimately, the circuit court determined that there was conflicting evidence on that point and did not make the finding. And I think it's the state's obligation to prove that was told to Mr. Sumner. And so I don't think that's there. I also, I do not, and if I said something that suggested this, I certainly retract it, because I don't believe his refusals to search can be considered at all in the calculus here. And so
what you said was the refusal to search coupled with something else, some type of hiding gesture perhaps, might provide or come closer to reasonable suspicion.
When I was making an analogy to the flight situation, and if it was refusal and at the same time you were, I mean, it really wouldn't be the refusal at all. It would be the other conduct of trying to prevent the officer from looking at something that he was in, that
locking
was in plain view.
Locking the car doors.
Locking the car doors, grabbing something and throwing it over the front seat so that he couldn't see something. I mean, that's different than a refusal to search. It's some affirmative act that prevents the plain sight. And so in terms of the big question the court asks is as to why this isn't reasonable suspicion. And I can make some comparisons to Johnson and Kyle's. The reaching gesture in this case is, I think, far less suspicious than the one that was described in Johnson. We do have the passage of time, which I haven't talked about yet, but I do think mitigates the weight that can be placed on that reaching gesture. And then in terms of Kyle's, because we don't have a baggy coat and we don't have a high crime area, we also have a significantly less suspicious situation than was in Kyle's. Now, as to the mitigation question, I think that, for example, in a driving situation, if an officer sees the driver cross the center line, and then he does it three times in a minute, well, at that point, I think the officer is going to think about pulling him over. If the next time he crosses the center line is 15 minutes later, that first one is mitigated. It's not going to be considered nearly as significant, and it suggests that it could be due to some innocent type of cause or inadvertence. And the reaching gesture has so many possible innocent explanations that since it's not accompanied by anything suspicious by Mr. Sumner, I think the time does mitigate it. If a dog growls at me, that's going to put me on edge. But if it just then just rolls over and lays down for 15 minutes, my worries about that dog, even if it starts to do something potentially aggressive 15 minutes later, are less than if it did something potentially aggressive immediately after it growled at me. Time does certainly make a difference here. And I think that's what the court was saying and more, is that and that's a short opinion, and I'm not sure that all the facts are fully stated there, but I think what's happening there is that there wasn't much evidence about what was going on with the passenger Moore during that 20-minute period of time. The court said, well, it's obvious that he wasn't doing anything suspicious during that time because we have no testimony about that, and the court can consider that, again, as part of the totality of the circumstances. The Court of Appeals, every time I hear the state's argument or read it, I feel like they're saying that the Court of Appeals concluded that the delay eliminated any consideration of the reaching gesture. And the Court of Appeals emphasized several times that they were considering as an important consideration the reaching gesture. But ultimately, with the other factors and the passage of time, it didn't rise to the level of reasonable suspicion. And I think one of the factors is this reaching gesture in the first place just is not that suspicious. The state cites in its reply brief the first brief, some cases from other jurisdictions for the proposition that delay does not extinguish reasonable suspicion. I mean, in one of those cases, for instance, the officer went to the car and saw a firearm, then went back and he waited some period of time before he did the pat-down search. Well, no matter how much time passes in that case, that firearm is still there and provides a reasonable suspicion. But in this case, there's nothing concrete like that. Another one of the cases from Colorado, I think Jackson, there was that extra layer of the driver affirmatively covering up the weapon in that case. And Jackson from Colorado recognizes that when there is delay, that raises concerns about post-search rationalization of the basis for the search.
Mr. Albee, let me ask you this, because this is the one factor that troubles me about the argument you're making. To suggest that delay should be a factor in mitigation suggests to me that there shouldn't have been a delay in this case. Yet as I see the facts of this case, unless you have additional factors that might lead an officer to reasonably suspect that a person is armed and dangerous, the reaching in and of itself, it was no basis to frisk or pat down Mr. Sumner earlier in the process. In other words, the state's argued, as I understand it, that it was an accumulation of factors, and the state's argued three, as I understand it. I don't know whether or not the failure to have identification and the driving with a suspended license should be added to those factors, but the state's argued three factors that it highlights, two of which didn't come up until later in the stop. So until those two factors are added later to the mix, I'm not sure what, if anything, other than your suggestion that the officer have him get out of the vehicle, I'm not sure what else the officer could have done here.
There's not a criticism of the officer for not getting the person out of the vehicle, other than it just sort of is reflective of what his state of mind is. And his state of mind is that reaching gesture wasn't significant enough that I really believe that this person has a weapon or concealed a weapon. That reaching gesture was so vague and has so many innocent explanations that I'm not doing anything with that. I mean, it's a very weak indicator.
And I accept your argument. And so initially, the officer doesn't have that concern. I accept that. But I think the state's argument is that, however, when the engagement occurs further down the road and you see nervousness, you see hands going into pockets, and in the context of a person who doesn't have identification, I mean, nobody's argued, but the lack of identification may or may not be a factor in this case. When you add all those things in together, doesn't it change the equation from simply the reach? I guess that's the question I'm trying to press you on.
Well, again, I agree with the Court of Appeals that reach is mitigated by the time, but not eliminated. And so what we have is a weak factor that's further mitigated by time, not eliminated, and then add it to hands in the pockets, which weren't enough in Kyle's, and this is significantly less than the situation in Kyle's, and nervousness, which is mostly based on the hands in the pockets, and albeit the sweating, which was explained by being a warm day and he'd been in the car.
I'm not sure the sweating adds anything in this case.
Well, it is.
Not in July.
So,
just interrupt a moment. What's the significance that the trial court didn't, whether or not the defendant was directed to take the napkin out of his pocket or that he agreed to take it out of his pocket or didn't take it out of his pocket and who put it on the car? Is that at all significant? Because by the time they look into the napkin, they've already had found drugs through the waistband search, apparently.
I believe it's significant. First of all, the circuit court found, although no one testified to the fact, that he was directed to take it out.
Right.
I think that's the same as reaching in yourself. So proceeding on that assumption that it's either reaching in yourself or directing to, which is the equivalent, I think it is an issue because there was not a specific finding as to when those bindles that were found on the ground came out. Mr. Sumner testified that all the bindles were in the napkin, and he would be the one who would know. I don't think there was sufficient evidence or testimony from the officer who said my attention was drawn to the ground, and he assumed that they fell out of his pants leg. But I don't think that if he's looking at Mr. Sumner, I don't think that these two very small bindles falling out really draws attention as much as at some point seeing on the ground that the bindles were there. I think it's reasonable to conclude, especially based on Mr. Sumner's testimony, that those came out when the napkin was removed from the pocket, and that was an illegal search.
And if those items came out when the napkins were removed, and should this court find that the initial pat-down was permissible, we still have this issue. The fact that the trial court did not make a credibility finding between Mr. Sumner's testimony and Officer Johnson's testimony, what do we do with that? Do we have to send that back for the trial court to make a determination of credibility? Because the finding, as you pointed out, and you seem to agree with Mr. Kleinmeier, that there's no evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding that he was directed to take it out. So it's got to be one or the other from the testimony. Do we send that back and let the circuit court make that determination?
I think that probably is the right course if the court finds that there's no support for the circuit court's finding. Now, whether the circuit court can reach some reasonable inference based on the two conflicting testimonies that he was directed to take it out, or that seems to be the most sensible option, that's up to the court, I guess. But as it stands now, that is the factual finding. Under that basis, I think the evidence needs to be suppressed. I certainly believe that Mr. Sumner's testimony is more credible on that point, but I would agree this court, I think, can't make that kind of credibility finding.
Can you clarify for me the testimony regarding the officer saying to the defendant that the vehicle would have to be towed and that he would be walking home, not driving home?
The officer, well, Mr. Sumner testified that he was told he'd be let go and walking home. The officer, I think, initially said that he agreed with a question of mine along those lines, and then later said, I'm not sure that I told him he'd be walking home. And then the circuit court made a finding that it was preposterous or ridiculous or something along those lines.
The reason I ask is the circuit court made this finding. The court further finds that the defendant was advised that his vehicle would have to be towed and that he would be walking home, not driving home.
This is at petition in the red brief at page petitioner app 121, bottom of the page, red brief.
Thank you, Chief. So I read that sentence to be just as it sounds, that he was advised that he, so that court finds that. Then the next sentence, the court does not find in the testimony, nor do I find it to be credible, that the defendant was told that he would have to leave and walk home shortly. So,
do you find those conflicting findings?
The only difference is the word shortly that I can see.
I think the other difference that could be discerned here, Justice Bradley, is that the second sentence says, I do not find it to be credible that the defendant was told he could leave. And the first sentence doesn't include the phrase, he could leave.
Well, no, but it does. It does say, the court further finds that the defendant was advised that his vehicle would not, that his vehicle would have to be towed and that he would be walking home, not driving home. You are correct. The first sentence does not say that he could leave and would be walking home. Maybe it's silly for me to think that saying to someone that you'll be walking home means that you would be leaving. I mean, I find it just inconsistent. I don't understand it.
Look at the next paragraph. I'm sorry, go ahead. Can you explain that?
Well, there is a potentially an important distinction between the two, which is the first one's advising Mr. Sumner as to what's going to be happening. The second one, as to being told he could leave, arguably would end the detention. And, of course, one of our issues is that he was detained beyond the point where he should have been. So the court finding that he could not leave or wasn't told that he could leave would support the fact that he was still detained.
It seems to me it plays both ways. It may play one way with regard to when he was detained, but it also, if he said that the defendant would be walking home, not driving, that seems to be another circumstance that would reflect a state of mind, but it's not clear to me what was said.
And then look at page 123 at the bottom. Court further finds from the credible testimony that he, and I'm assuming that relates to the officer, directed the defendant to take what was in his pocket out. The court finds that it was reasonable under the totality of the circumstances to direct him to take that out, whereupon he did. So trial court found that the officer directed him to take it out of his pocket.
Yes, and that it's on that factual basis that I would say that evidence has to be suppressed, because I believe that the bindles fell out when the illegal search of the napkin being ordered to be pulled out.
The counsel, you agree that no one testified to what the trial court found. Mr. Sumner testified he was ordered to take it out and did by the officer. And the officer testified that he took it out on his own, right?
That's true.
Right. So there's no testimony that the officer ordered him to take it out. And Sumner said the officer reached in his pocket and took it out. And the officer said Sumner did it, but nobody said the officer ordered Sumner to take it out.
Correct. And, well, I guess my time's up.
Well, you ask that you want to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals, and that would reverse the judgment of conviction. Is he entitled to another trial?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. You want to affirm the Court of Appeals,
yes,
right? If it should be reversed, the Court of Appeals should be reversed, what are your requests of this court?
If it's reversed, on the first issue, I guess, as to the reasonable suspicion, I would still be asking that the circuit court be reversed on the basis of the other issues that we have raised. And there are two other issues upon which I believe Mr. Sumner could be granted relief and the evidence suppressed.
You want the Court of Appeals affirmed, correct?
Yes,
I do.
And then I think the question is, do you think he gets a new trial? Is that the relief, or what happens next?
Do you just send it back for a special finding on who directed what about the napkin? I mean, you have alternatives here. The best one you can get is to affirm the Court of Appeals, because that, in effect, wipes out the conviction, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. But if you're not going to win all the way, then what are your alternatives?
If the court finds that there are issues remaining that can't be determined by this court because of the need for a factual finding, then we would request remand on those factual issues.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kleinmeier?
This court said circuit courts are aptly positioned to decide on a case-by-case basis, evaluating the totality of the circumstances and reasonable suspicion. In this case, the trial court evaluated the circumstances, and even on in the appendix, page 129, it's page 78 of the transcript, the court took into account the 15-minute delay and said the frisk was still reasonable. In other words, the court who's aptly positioned to look at the totality found that there was reasonable suspicion. The Court of Appeals, in reversing, is the one who cites Moore and basically says there's more, incorporates more of an ironclad rule that when you have a delay or don't get someone out of the car, then you lose the reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Kleinmeier, let me ask you this. This is what troubles me about this case. Whether the court finds reasonable suspicion or not, whether the court upholds the pat down or not, the reality is that no heroin was discovered until after a napkin exited the rear pants pocket of Mr. Sumner. That's when the heroin is discovered, as I understand the facts in this case.
Yes.
So if that's when the heroin is discovered, do we not have to first determine which factual account is correct in terms of whether the officer reached in and pulled the napkin out? Because if the officer reached in and pulled the napkin out, that's not part of a legitimate frisk, as I understand it.
Right.
And if, or whether or not the defendant on his own pulled it out and set it on the hood of the car, as I understand the officer's testimony. Don't we still have to resolve that issue one way or the other? And given the trial court's finding here that the officer directed the defendant to take it out, which everyone seems to agree is not part of the testimony in this case, don't we have to get an answer from the circuit court as to that question?
Well, the question when you asked this before to Mr. Albee, I think you made a comment about no credibility determination. The trial court did make a credibility determination, a general determination, at pages 124 and 125, in the appendix page 124 and 125, it's pages 73 and 74 of the transcript. It says, I make these findings based upon what the court finds to be credible testimony from Deputy Johnson. And then appendix page 125 says, I do find the deputy's testimony to be more credible, and accordingly I've made these findings consistent with that. So there is a credibility determination. Now, the question. Wouldn't have to send it back, I don't think, although if it comes down to that and the court's not willing to make the determination based on the credibility finding, then I think it probably would have to go back. There would be one way it wouldn't, in the sense that the officer, whoever took it out, the napkin out of the pocket and placed it in the car, whatever the circumstances are for getting it on the car, when the items fell to the ground, it's the officer said, "What are those?" And then at that point, Mr. Sumner said, "Heroin." At that point, the officer arrested him, and subsequent to that, looked at the package that's been taken out of the pocket and put on the car.
So doesn't it make a difference how it got out of the pocket?
According to the trial court's finding on that, I think that this was after the napkin was placed on the car, the officers had resumed the frisk, and at that point, when he resumed it, he saw packets fall out of the lake. So if they just happened to fall out while he's conducting a frisk, I mean, if he's patting down and something falls out, it seems to me those are totally independent from the stuff that's placed on the car. And it was the ones that fell to the ground that prompted the arrest. So in that point, the arrest came about totally separate from the stuff being placed on the car. And
it's the items that fell. I guess the point of my question is, at least from the briefs and the appendixes in the briefs, it would seem to have been suggested by both parties that the focus here was the bindles that fell to the ground. And it seemed to me, and if I'm incorrect, correct me, it seemed to me that neither of you disagree with each other that the likelihood is that the bindles fell to the ground when the napkin came out of the pocket.
Oh, I see. No, I, okay. I, yeah, I.
Now, just, if I'm incorrect, please correct me.
Let me see if I can find the description. Say it should be, I think it's going to be in the transcript of pages 13 to 14, the officer's testimony. It said something about going back to the waistband. And then, yeah, okay, this is the officer's testimony. This is the transcript is document 21 at pages 13 to 14. He says, this is his description that he asked. He originally felt the napkin in the pocket, or felt the item in the pocket. Asked him what it was. Mr. Sumner said it was a napkin. Mr. Sumner removed it, placed it in the trunk. And then the officer went to the waistband area in the front, and at that point, his attention was drawn to the ground where he saw two small bindles fall out of the pant leg. And he said, "Oh, what's that?" And Mr. Sumner said it was heroin. Now, under that version, the stuff fell out after the napkin was placed on the car. And under that, then the arrest was made totally independent from the napkin being placed on the car.
Counselor, one quick question. Do you know if there's any testimony in the record that from any person who testified that it was standard policy to do an inventory search when a car was to be towed?
No, there is not. There is testimony that it was a practice to do the towing, but as far as the search, there was no testimony. It's the state's theory that followed because there was the state in its brief in the trial court mentioned it was an inventory search. Subsequent to that, the defendant, in a brief that was filed subsequent to the state's brief, never challenged a search apart from the initial stop and the frisk. And at the beginning of the suppression hearing, the defense said the concern was the stop, not the statements. So there was no reason in that context for the state to introduce any testimony about the search, the car search, being an inventory search.
Justice Bradley.
In follow-up to Justice Butler's question, could the court's finding with regard to the officer directing the defendant to take the napkin out of his pocket be a reasonable inference from the testimony?
I don't think it could in this case because each witness, the officer and Mr. Sumner, was very clear on his own testimony. And, I mean, the officer said Mr. Sumner took it out. Mr. Sumner said the officer took it out. There's no indication that the officer told Mr. Sumner to take it out or even suggested he take it out.
Who knows, but it seems to me plausible that it's a judge's thought processes that, hey, is it likely that a defendant is going to willingly take this out of his pocket? Like, oh, here, let me take this out of the pocket. So it seems to me reasonable to infer that maybe the defendant did take it out of his pocket, but it was at the direction of someone. I mean, is that, can we accept that as a reasonable inference? I mean, the testimony doesn't have to be in the record. The law is, has to be testimony in the record or reasonable inferences therefrom.
I don't think it's a reasonable inference after this, the trial judge, on two different occasions, two different pages of the transcript, finds the officer credible. And then to say the officer's credible, but you're not going to believe the officer as to how the packet got out of the, I mean, how the packet, the napkin got out of the pocket, seems inconsistent. Now, as to Justice Butler, if the court does not accept the idea that these two packets fell to the ground independent from the napkin coming out, then I think the appropriate remedy is to send it back for the trial court, make a finding, not new testimony, but make a finding on the testimony that's there as to how these packets were removed from Mr. Sumner's pocket. And then that would resolve that question. And if the judge says, nope, I intended under all that inference, the judge can make that statement. But I got to, in light of the other findings by the court, which was consistent with the officer's testimony, I can't explain it, but it's certainly inconsistent to find the officer credible, to make findings consistent with the officer's testimony, except on that one point.
I ask, did the defendant serve his sentence or part of his sentence?
I believe he's still currently serving.
I think it would be probation, correct? I mean, in terms of the word sentence, it's probation. I mean, he received a sentence that was stayed, placed on probation.
Extended supervision.
He was not sent to prison?
Yeah, probation, because he was, the sentence was stayed and placed on probation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Mr. Albee, for yet another Terry search case. You've enlightened the court on not only this case, but other cases that we've had. That ends the hearing on 06-AP-0102, CR State versus Sumner. The court will be in recess until 1:30, when we'll hear the next case. The students who are staying may remain in the courtroom, and Justice Siegler will be out shortly to discuss the procedures of the court. Anyone who wants to stay other than the students can do that.